I want to start with a little bit of a preamble, because it occurred to me as I was sitting there that in all of the history of the universe, at least to date, there has never been a more expert grouping of people to answer the question, is time emergent or fundamental? And yet right at the moment, I don't have a sense of what you as a collective think is the answer to this question. So I'm going to begin just by asking you all. So who thinks, hand up, time is emergent? Either. These are two options. Vote for one or other. Emergent. Emergent. Come on.
Which time? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, there's
any time.
There's a time which is emergent.
Any time.
No, but if you ask the question like this, this is what I got.
That's okay. I don't mind. I don't mind.
Okay, I'm going to answer.
I'm asking one question. Is time emergent? Hands up. Without quibbling. Yes, I should do, probably. Who thinks time is fundamental?
It's
52%. See, it does, yep. Sorry. We will have to exit the universe in 2 years' time.
Can you ask another question?
But there is one more question.
You can ask in a little bit, but hang on, I've not finished this vote yet. Who raised their hands?
Can I ask for another vote?
Who raised their hands both times?
Can I ask for a vote about whether you can think, if anybody think that time is emergent while change is fundamental?
Gosh.
What is change?
I only wanted a quick answer to this question. It's clearly something we'll have to debate. So one of the topics for debate can be what is the correct question to ask at the end of the session. Because all I wanted to do is compare the numbers at the start and the numbers at the end, and I thought it would take 1 minute. This is proving that you cannot collect together a bunch of scientists without provoking an argument on the most simple thing. You can't get an answer to a simplistic question. This would be more like it. Okay, well, later on, what should we be asking? Yeah. Okay, I invite all of you, having made your answer, to think about what possible observation could persuade you, or theory development, could persuade you to change your mind. And if you can't come up with any answer to that, then I have to wonder why you've bothered to come to the conference in the first place.
And how many of us are wondering that?
Okay, anyway, panel discussion. I know nothing about time, so I ask these questions because I want to find out what people think so that I know what I should think. But there's lots of people here who actually know how to think and have their own opinions, and three of them are seated here, so we want to take advantage of that. I have collected together a few topics, which were things that came out of the earlier discussion to be picked up on again, so I've just written them down to give us a chance of covering them over the next hour and a little bit. But this is by no means meant to be a complete list, and if anyone wants to shout out an additional topic just now, I'll be more than happy to add it in. Yes? What is time? Well, what is change is already here. So what is change stroke time? Stuart? Mm-hmm. Criteria?
By if the laws change, why? For example, if
yes, I'm very keen to talk about that at some length, as you will be finding out in about 15 minutes' time. However, the place we're actually going to open up is that just before the end of the break, Carla was making a point that clearly merited more time than was available then, to make, I think, some general comments on the program as advocated by Lee and Roberto in the first talk. So I will invite Carla just to make his points as briefly as possible, or even more briefly than possible, so that that can provoke a little bit of discussion on this topic to get the panel underway. So, Carlo.
Yes, it's a comment about point two, but since Lee Roberto program touches all other points, it's a really comment about all of them. Lee Roberts has written a book. Lee has given an eloquent defense of this line of things, and Roberto has summarized it in 3 points, presenting it as a radical departure from doing physics. And what has shocked me is that Francesca comes out saying, "Oh, this is a very reactionary." So let me try to what is going on here. Let me try to open up the story. The 3 point of Roberto first is that he tells us he pushes us to not think that there are regularities outside time, not think as there are absolute laws outside time. And Francesca answers, wait a minute. I mean, this is science, and this is physics in particular, which has changed its fundamental description of the world basically every half a century or every 40 years in the last half a millennium. This is a quintessential way of thinking, which is opening to changing. And there is a lot of us, probably not all of us, probably not Sean or a few of us, but a lot of us have a view of the world, which Laurent, I think, summarized extremely well, which was when he said, this is what we understand today, but I believe that what we understand today is a teeny fraction of what I might understand tomorrow. So theoretical physics leave, in my opinion, in a mind frame, which is this immense universe, I know nothing about it, I have certain amount of information, and in this realm that I have access to, I'm struggling to find some good description. There's a Humean way of viewing laws in which there's nothing compulsory, there's nothing outside time, there's nothing outside the universe. It's simply a way of condensing the regularity of the world which we observe in a short way, in a short language, and it's very much in the mind of physics. Gell-Mann used to say that a physical law is just a summary, a condensation of a lot of information about the world. This is, not present in your description of physics. It's completely opened this way of doing physics. I know that there is other ways of thinking physics. Now, the second point is that, let me go through the 3 points very rapidly.
Oh. Let Carlo finish. He's planned carefully. Let him finish.
The second point that Roberto made, it seems to me that what he says differs a little from what is in the book. It seems to me, Roberto says, there are histories, and we do want the local histories to stay together in a global history, so we certainly do, but whether they could be placed in a single time-like, it's a matter of empirical a ground, which he says here, I don't want to answer a priori. It seems that this is not what is in the book. Maybe, and I want to ask Roberto, are you conceding a little bit that the one-line historical time that appears in cosmology might be true and good in a first approximation, but when we break out the universe in all his components, maybe the temporal structure of the universe might be more complicated than that. There might be not a preferred foliation, for instance, of the kind that George wants, of Lee seems to be willing. So what remains? I think it remains a third point. The third point is very strong, very good, and I take it as a strong message, which I like to listen to. And the strong point is, wait a moment, in the moment in which you include cosmology, early universe, include all that, maybe the distinction between the sort of the law and the initial condition, the state and the Hamiltonian, the state and the, maybe this should go. Because this is grounded in the modality, if I do this, then this happen, if I do that, this is happen, and maybe this is not the right story about the right way of thinking a historical or a biological theory. So the third point seems strongly reminded for me. Last comment. Roberto also added that causation is fundamental. Maybe it is causation is fundamental, but I also hear from the philosophers a long story about causation perhaps not being fundamental, starting from Hume, but there's a much more recent version of it, which has nothing mental, nothing. It's a story of making sense about causation. So once again, Should we open to all possibility, or do we have to listen to somebody preaching us what causation has to be? Should we, like Francesca saying, wait, we don't know anything about the final structure of the world, we don't know anything about the temporal structure of the world, we're just open to learning step by step.
Thanks, Carlo. So I'm going to invite Lee and Roberto to respond very briefly to things that that might have brought up, but then I want to open it up to the room to make whatever comments. So Lee first.
To my understanding, it's working. Your third point is the answer to the first point. However we speak of laws, I'm happy to speak within that modern way of thinking of laws as summaries of regularities. And the statement that the laws may change is just a statement that were that done eons ago, or before the Big Bang, or 100 billion years into the future, the regularities, the patterns of the regularities would be different. So I think that's perfectly coherent. And the second point, I think Roberto would be better off addressing. And the third point, I agree. That's
okay, hands up
brief,
who could actually remember what the third point was by the end of that.
To be open to the possibility that there are different modalities of change, as I understood.
That
there's not necessarily change always is dictated by a Hamiltonian, but there could be other modalities of change, some of which might be summarized by saying that the Hamiltonian changes. But I want to emphasize the meta-law issue, because when Zhao and I answered Rob Mann's point, and Rob Mann said, well, you could just duplicate that by a scalar field. If you think so, you didn't understand. Where's Rob?
I'm here, you're right.
If you think you didn't understand what we were advocating.
I have this as a separate, yeah.
I would never excuse you of being disingenuous, yeah. Rob. I think there's a, what I mean is,
Lee, I have this as a separate, complete topic for the discussion, so I would like to keep the varying laws till then. Roberto, do you wish to speak?
I'll make just one very brief comment in the spirit of trying to understand, to locate our disagreement. So, the first and the third propositions in my substantive summary are different in spirit from the second. So, the first is that our discovery of the historical character of the universe might suggest to us that we should no longer develop science on the basis of the notion that there's a permanent structure of ultimate constituents of nature described by the standard model of particle physics and an eternal repertory of regularities, the laws, symmetries, and constants. We shouldn't make science depend on that. There's nothing nonsensical in dispensing with that notion. And the proof is that we do dispense with it in all the other sciences, in the life sciences, in social and historical thought, and so forth. And we go on, nevertheless, with our explanatory projects. Now, the third proposition is that we should not reify. We should not take as for keeps the ordinary presentation of nature in the cool-down universe that we observe, where there is a discriminate structure and a clear distinction between the structure and the regularities that govern it. Because nature may go through violent transformations, also suggested by our progressive discoveries about the history of the universe. So you might agree with these two propositions. And that would already be a great axis of division in contemporary cosmology. Then we come to the second proposition, to which you might nevertheless take exception. And my thesis would be that this affirmation of the radical and inclusive reality of time remains precarious unless we're able to make sense of the idea of a global or cosmic time. And to reconcile that idea with the undisputed discoveries of relativity. So to perform that operation, we would have to subject relativity to a radical reinterpretation. And that then is a second plane of controversy. So the way I understand our conversation up to now is that you agree with the first and the third, but disagree with the second. And that already begins to shape our debate, because we see that there are two different axes of division emerging in this conversation.
Thanks, Alberto. So I'd like to open it up to other people. Andy is first, then Chris, then Raphael, and then I'll be trying to remember the sea of hands that follow.
So I have a question for Lee, which I think is kind of minor, but in the grand scheme of things. But when you have these properties of the theory change at the singularity, I think to have the phenomenon that you describe, you need the changes to be small in some sense. And I'm curious to what extent you've developed that aspect, the smallness, does it, you know, have you put sort of, I don't know, domains of convergence and divergence down? Have you formulated it in that way?
Chris already has the mic.
What do you mean when you say we're changing the parameter of generation to generation is small? And what, how small, and what's the criteria, where did it come from? This I learned a lot from, everything I know about this I learned from Stu, so it's good that he's here. Whether or not mutations accumulate depends on the size of them
and on the structure of the fitness landscape. And I have done a little preliminary work a long time ago, but certainly not adequate to the task. We try to estimate some properties of the fitness landscape in the neighborhood of our universe and address those issues. And maybe Stu could now or later address that. It's a long time. It's back in the mid-90s that we worked on that. And nothing came out that we thought was worth writing up.
And a class of things to think about are spin glasses turned upside down, because biologists go uphill in fitness and you guys go downhill in energy. If you think, or just leave it a spin glass. If you think of something evolving, like changing laws, changing on some criteria, any criterion of success you want, it's going to generate something like a fitness landscape. So for Lee, it was universes that have lots of baby holes have more daughter universes. So there's a selection for it. Now, if whatever it is changes too dramatically, whatever the selection criteria is, fails, and the system just melts out over the space of possibilities. It's in the case of a flagpole landscape, where there's a pole on a flat landscape, it's the Eigenschuster error catastrophe. Whatever it is, the changes have to be small enough so that whatever the criteria is, or criterion are, it could win. And it's a kind of a Darwinian notion that you appealed to Lee, and that's what we talked about a long time ago. A lot's known about that if one wants to think about the criteria by which evolving laws change, and if it's ever the consequences of the laws, then this becomes relevant.
Okay, thanks. Let me just say, I want all of the questions currently are supposed to be on-topic questions, so I'm assuming by default everyone is raising one finger regardless of what part.
Can I just ask something?
Appendage appears. Please do.
I was just wondering, you know, in a way there is also the concept of cataclysm, right? Things can change abruptly and dramatically, which the equivalent thing for us would be exactly the opposite of what Andy said, but it would be like a phase transition in which you change the symmetry, you change everything. So it would be very interesting to actually incorporate or bring or import what happens in evolutionary biology into this concept. And I don't know exactly what your views are on this.
Well, the main thing to say is that nobody knows. But there's a fairly well-developed theory for what an adaptive process looks like on some kind of landscape. And these could be adaptive processes on some kind of landscape under whatever the criteria are that one thinks is reasonable. And in general, the basic idea is if you're wiggling around slowly enough on that space by whatever you're wiggling, in Lee's case, how much do the constants change in baby universes? And the selection force, it's not a selection force, it's just what wins, is, if you will, stronger, selection will win and you'll get to some local peak. If not, you won't. And that's a very general notion. Now, whether or not that picture is true of real biological evolution when coevolution is happening and so on, who knows? Because then it becomes a general dynamical system. It's not a flow on a potential. Okay, so it's much more complicated.
Okay, I'm going to move on to Chris, who's been waiting a while.
This is a question for Lee and Roberto. So Lee, you gave a very concise summary of an argument that's in the book, but there was one part that I was puzzled by and I thought it might be interesting to raise, and that's in characterizing the sense in which time is strong. At one point you said, we wouldn't want to have an exact mathematical representation of the universe. That would be another copy, and it would be in conflict with the claim that the universe is unique, and that that was motivating the sense in which time is strong in the account you're giving. And I was curious about that because it seems the question of how it is that math is applied to understanding the universe in physics, it seems like here you're taking a position where a full mathematical description would in fact be an exact copy of the universe. And I was wondering if you could just explain that. I might have missed the argument or missed some of the subtlety, but that was surprising to me.
It is surprising. And you can parse better than I can, and Roberto has a lot to say about this too, the subtleties of this kind of argument. And I step very gingerly into issues of foundations of mathematics and philosophy of mathematics. But so let me just talk very plainly and working class at the outset. When I went into physics, I believed that our job was to find a mathematical object which was an exact mirror of reality, such that every property in nature was mapped one-to-one to a property, a provable property of this mathematical object. And within the Newtonian paradigm, there is such a mathematical object, the trajectory in the state space which corresponds to the evolution of the system you're studying. It may be oversimplified, it may be incomplete, but in principle, it's meant to be exactly that. So part of our argument is to be skeptical about such correspondences. And if you remember, I skipped a transparency. The slide that I skipped made an argument related to an argument that Barbara made 2 days ago, or yesterday, sorry, it's been a long meeting. That any description of a subsystem has to be, and this was alluded to by Laurent as well, has to be incomplete because it's a truncation. So there's a natural move to say you consider larger and larger subsystems and include more and more degrees of freedom and you truncate less and less, and you converge to a description which is a precise mathematical map or precisely in correspondence between the mathematical object and the history of the universe. But then we want to say no, because then you're at the level where you're subject to all these criticisms we've made of extending the Newtonian paradigm to the system as a whole. So there's a kind of a dilemma whose consequence is that any claim for an exact mathematical description of a part of nature is necessarily incomplete in a description of a truncation. And this is what Barbara said. And it is shocking if you've grown up with the metaphysics in which behind the world is a mathematical object. It requires you to think, I think, Barbara, if I can use you, that when we say that classical mechanics is a good description of some body of fact, what we really can refer to is classical mechanics truncated to n digits, to n decimal places. And there is some n in every application such that classical mechanics truncated to n decimal places is good enough for the experimental agreement we get. But classical mechanics truncated to n digits is not deterministic. So the whole bunch of metaphysical baggage connected with determinism goes out the window for a seemingly trivial restriction in the applicability of the theory. And that's the kind of move that we're making here. Having dispensed with the idea that there's an exact mathematical representation of the history of the world, we then look for an argument that to make us comfortable with that. And so in the way that we formulated with Roberto our argument, the first assumption, the original way we formulated it, is that the universe is singular, i.e. it's something which is unique, it happens once, there are no copies, there's no ensemble. And we took the postulation, we took this to also rule out this kind of Platonic idea in which there's a physical world and a mathematical world, and then physics is a case of discovering a map between them. So that all could be said in a much more sophisticated way, but I think my meaning is plain.
As a general chair comment, I do feel this discussion could be a little bit crisper. People are talking a lot, and so I'm very keen to encourage short questions and responses to as far as possible in the panel discussions. Long questions and responses will be perfect for dinner. Robert.
Okay, so then. My comment is actually something that I think supports what you are saying, Lee, and also what you are saying, Joao. And I would like to make the comment very provocative to cosmologists who think they can avoid these issues. So my claim is the following. I think that all inflationary cosmologists, are assuming that the Hilbert space of state is changing as a function of time, and they are assuming unjustified initial conditions as time goes on. This is a so-called Trans-Planckian problem for cosmological perturbations, and I can easily afterwards draw a space-time graph. So I think cosmologists, inflationary cosmologists, have to tackle this problem head on. And they are not doing that, they are trying to wash it under the rug.
Can I comment? I was going to comment as well. Okay. If I knew how to solve it, I would. Since I don't even try.
So there's one, of course, this is a bit matters of taste, but I think the best way to avoid that would be to use fermion fluctuations as the motor of the fluctuations we see. Because then you really don't have issues with vacuum and all these matters. You know?
Even if inflation is true, there's no evidence that the inflaton field exists now. So it's perfectly compatible with the scenario where the inflaton field exists for some brief period, and then no longer exists, and then the fields of the standard model later exist.
Okay, we're going to take a few more comments, but this particular subtopic on the board, I'm going to close off about 5:10 at the latest, so that we're not talking only about this for an entire hour. Next is Raphael.
Okay, I actually had two on topic and one off topic comments. So
you can have at most two on topic ones.
I will do one on topic and get in line for the next.
Okay, good.
And the particular one is, it's come up several times, both I think in George's talk yesterday and Roberto's discussion today, that they seem to feel, and I would agree with this, that time is real. If you mean by time, there's genuine change, there's genuine becoming, whatever word you like, werden, whatever fancy word you want to attach to this. But this is really a very basic aspect of reality, and our experience is not misleading on this in this way. But they seem to think that this can only be realized if you have a global time. So it's what I would call synchronous becoming. So in the space-time point of view, you need to have a distinguished slicing. And this I would strongly hope is not true and disagree with, because it conflicts with relativity. So instead of laying out a whole picture, and I think Faye will do a little bit to lay out some of this picture tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, let me just give a word for what I think we should be searching for. Sometimes just to have a term to fasten on helps to guide thought. The term I would propose is asynchronous becoming, something which you can, if you want an analogy, think of doing parallel computing. Each little processor is whirring away, and it needs the results from some other processors, other processes. It doesn't need results from others. And so from its point of view, things are happening everywhere, but there's no causal order between certain, as we would call, space-like thing. So that's an image. So I just want to sort of underline that word. Asynchronous becoming, I think, is what we ought to be looking for.
Thanks, Raphael. I'm going to interpret that that's a comment. The panel doesn't necessarily have to respond to everything that's said. If the panel wants to, it will. I have Jimena, then Henrique, then Janan. And I think I'm going to close this off soon to move to a different topic. We can return if there is more time, but...
Okay, thank you. So I want to bring the questions to a different direction, and that's to explore the consequences for political philosophy from this particular philosophy of science and science and philosophy of science. So this view clearly makes a lot of sense, common sense, and I think that that's reflected in the vote. But common sense has been taken out of science. You know, it was very important during the Scottish Enlightenment, for example. But it's not the way that that science has done it. It's also different. Common sense is different from experience. So I take Roberto's point that we're not talking here about Lebensphilosophie or phenomenology. But the taking away common sense from science is a 20th century phenomena tied to the rise of the authority of the expert knowledge. So if we don't have that, then we have science by plebiscite, or science by referendum, which is what we what we just did. And Thomas Kuhn, philosophers of science, have denied that way of doing science. The closest, I think, would be Habermasian philosophy. So it's not a plebiscite, but it's reasonable discourse that then creates the truth. So I'd like some clarification on that. And also one of the appeal, I think, for the laws that do not change tied to political philosophy is that they're like commandments. They're like moral commandments. So once you have laws that change, you have the problem of moral relativism. And that, of course, is something that's very scary for our political and social and moral situation. So I wanted to hear some, you flesh out a little bit in more detail the philosophical lineage that will help us understand the motivations and the political motivations of this type of doing science.
If somebody wishes to comment, Roberto would be best qualified, I think.
I really think science is a dictatorship of experiment. Because ultimately, that's, we can all, have referendum and everything, but experiment.
Well, so we used to think in social and historical thought that unless we believed in higher order laws of structural change, we would be forced into causal agnosticism. Now, no one believes that there are these meta-historical laws. And nevertheless, we continue to develop causal and structural ideas about discontinuous change in history, in the making and unmaking of regimes. And we think that there are long periods of social experience in which social life becomes relatively frozen, and we think falsely that the established regime is eternal and universal, and then other periods in which these regimes are melted down in a revolutionary fervor. The structures are reinvented and new regularities are produced together with them. Now, that provides an inspiration for rethinking in cosmology. The enemy of that inspiration is the example of mathematics. And there I want to make a claim that's stronger than the accommodating claim that Lee made. Mathematics is the enemy. Mathematics gives science, natural science, the poison chalice of the idea of eternal laws of nature. And the conception of mathematics that is implicit in this view is that mathematics is an exploration of a simulacrum of the world from which time and phenomenal particularity have been sucked out. And its power is directly dependent on its radical selectivity. In this kind of science, we have to affirm the priority of physical intuition over mathematical analysis.
Thanks, Alberto. So, okay, Henrique has been waiting a long time. His is going to be the last question on this topic for the time being. Sorry to everyone else, but there is just too many hands.
So I just wanted a clarification from Lee and Marina and Roberto. You said there is a unique history of the universe, but is that a postulate or is that an observation? Because, I mean, if you take into account quantum phenomena, you don't know what the history of the universe is. You could have multiple past histories of the universe. And do you take of a Bohmian view? What is this unique history of the universe? The universe is given once, and how important is it for you to have that?
It's very important to avoid certain conclusions that I think come from making the cosmological fallacy. And what, if you want to ask about what notion of quantum mechanics is friendly to it, you mentioned Bohm, which is a realist view of quantum mechanics, and that's good enough. You can discuss it in other versions of quantum mechanics, but Bohm is certainly good enough.
So if you're doing, the fact of being unique is only true for when you're doing the theory of the whole universe. And also in the cases where you take an event or every interaction together with its causal past. In that sense, in cosmology, every event is unique. There are no two events that have the same causal past and the same relations between all the other events in its history, in their history. This is, you can't argue with this. It's clear. Cosmology happens once. If you we only have one copy of the universe. So if you lay out a theory for the whole universe, there are no two events that have exactly the same properties in the sense of having the exact same past, causal past, because then you're confusing separations in space or. You know, one electron may interact here and then may interact again later on. The two events will not be the same in cosmology. When, like Lee said and Barbara, when you truncate subsystems of the universe, then you're kind of coarse graining and looking for effective theory laws, and those systems, subsystems, will indeed look similar, and there will appear to be many copies of them around the universe. In cosmology, it's the only science where every event in the ultimate level is unique.
Okay, I am going to terminate this topic, and the reason is because almost everyone in the room has been waiting to speak, and so that must be the perfect time to end when it's perfectly fair. We may have time to come back to it, but I don't want to talk about this for the entire hour and a half. So we're going to move on to meaning of changing laws. I'm going to say a couple of opening comments on this around what I think I understand of it, to see whether it fits into anything that Joao or Lee meant. So my understanding of laws of physics is that the dominant paradigm for a long time has been they're formulated as Lagrangian or Hamiltonian laws, and you're allowed to put in fields of various kinds and implement symmetries. In the old days, you put in a pile of constants, like Newton's constant G. If you want to do something you think is changing the laws, one of the things you can do is take all the constants out and replace them with scalar fields, like in Brands-Dickey theory, and insert dynamical terms for them. And then that's just another Lagrangian law. So to me, that doesn't change the physical law at all. That sees its maybe hypothesis in the string landscape cosmology that leads to the multiverse, where essentially all of the constants in the standard model or variants on the standard model are all caused by brains and fluxes and other things. So the constants, the things you thought were constants, are all instead somehow dynamically arising under the governance of some laws. In different parts of the multiverse, you might argue the laws of physics are different, because you might have the standard model here, but some completely different gauge group somewhere else, or no gauge group somewhere else. But that's really just because you're looking at the theory, which is the effective theory around the vacuum in that region of space. There is some mega theory, which is presumably string theory in this case, but it has an enormously large number of vacuum states that could fool us into thinking that the laws are different in different places or are changing when really they're not. I don't think that's very different from just that somewhere in the history of our universe, the electroweak symmetry got broken Was that a change of physical laws? It's a phase transition, suddenly you have different things. I don't really think so, because it's part, again, of some bigger theory. João, I think, was saying something a bit bolder. He was saying that in the Lagrangian, you're going to break some of the more fundamental principles, like time translation invariance. He's going to stick in T as an actual symbol in the Lagrangian, perhaps. Now, that T looks like a parameter, but it has to be the same T that's also going to be the coordinate under whose symmetry you generate energy conservation through time translation invariance, and I don't know whether that's well or badly motivated. But what I didn't get a sense of was whether João was also willing to abandon completely the idea that there might be a Lagrangian or a Hamiltonian and think of physical laws as coming from some deeper substrate from which the whole idea of a Lagrangian might itself somehow be effective. And then Lee seemed to be saying something even stronger, which is you couldn't even have that substrate. There was no sense in which there was some overarching meta law from which all these apparent varying physical laws might emerge. So I've seen this kind of tree of things, and I've just said that as I hope it's helpful orientation that maybe our speakers can locate where they are in this space of possibilities. So I will invite, I guess, João perhaps to speak first and then open up to the crowd. I'm going to look away, put your hands up, and I'm going to look now. And I'm going to favor people who haven't spoken before, otherwise you're bouncing further down the queue. Okay, so I've seen two people so far.
So I think you summarized it very well, and I think indeed, you know, it is this explicit tip dependence that provides at least a minimal mechanism for having variability. I think what Lee did is more radical. But so with regards to the issue of Lagrangian, I think Lagrangians were invented precisely for laws which didn't change in time. And doesn't mean you can't have like dissipation functions in Lagrangians and things which have variability. The Lagrangian mechanism doesn't like it very much. So you can be put in by hand, but it's awkward. Whereas the Hamiltonian formalism, because it relies on a split, a priori, is something which is more amenable to introduce this variability. But this is a technical issue, and I think the point is exactly that. This is not having another scalar field which motivates changes in constants. It's building in the variability into the formalism.
Okay, Renata's first.
A comment to you both. So I'm, despite the many words, I'm slightly confused by the nature of meta laws or whatever, encompassing laws where I allow my constants to vary. The issue number one is that supposed to be unique? Should it have fewer parameters than the ones I'm already, you know, wanting to explain that, you know, there's the 29 parameters that Lee is coming back to? Well, what about uniqueness? And if it's not unique, am I not then back to the infinite regress?
I think there's an issue, which is once you have variability, you don't need to explain the numbers. I mean, why is the illumination in this room what it is? It's because I switched on the light. Why 1 over 137 for alpha? If alpha is a constant, you have a good reason for trying to explain 137. If it varies, it's circumstantial, and you actually don't need to worry about that as much. So you just shift the philosophy completely. So you have fewer things to explain because they're functions.
So that seems to be a bit of a cop-out, I mean,
yeah,
frankly.
No, Renata, yeah. Those were good questions. And I think they need to be investigated. One thing that I did to investigate it was investigate a hypothesis that the meta laws fell into equivalence class. So I invented, I'm not going to go into the technicalities, but I invented a little matrix model trying to realize the idea that that states and laws were the same thing. And a very simple interaction gave rise to what looked like law-like behavior for a portion of the state, which remained the state. Sorry if that was confusing. But let me ask if there's a notion of a universal meta-law in the same sense that there's a universal notion of computation. That is, all computers implement the same idea of computation. And I tried to get a specification of what a meta-law was from which I could derive a universality result that any operation in this matrix model that satisfied these criteria was equivalent under some transformation to any other. And I can refer you to that paper for the details.
But you're giving me one very specific idea, and then you're arguing for universality within that. I know.
For me, I don't want it to be confusing. For me, these are hypotheses to be investigated. So if I publish a model as cosmological natural selection, that doesn't mean that every idea about changing laws falls under that. It's a hypothesis to be investigated, and your questions are important questions to be investigated by constructing models and seeing if you can answer them in an interesting way.
So am I next?
Yes, Barbara, please.
Okay, so I can make a lot of sense of the concept of changing laws within our universe when new objects arise and we have new laws describing them, as we have discussed before. So the laws of economy only originated when economies were here. Principle of natural selection only arose when biological species were here, and so on. So in this sense, I can understand very well the idea of changing laws. If these are strongly emergent, then I would like to ask Lee, and that's the first question, then I will ask a second question. So the first question is, if these are strongly emergent, how can you postulate, as your first postulate, causal closure for your meta-theory? Because strongly emergent things are not causally dependent, fully dependent on something else. And the other question is also very brief. Where do you see the boundary between physics and metaphysics? Because many questions that you raise that go beyond our cosmos, for me, are metaphysics questions and not physics questions.
I'm not worried about questions being brief. I'm worried about answers being brief.
The role, for me, I'm a physicist, the role of speculation, whether you call it metaphysical or whatever you call it, is to encourage the invention of hypotheses that have testable consequences by experiment. And the first is a good question I don't know the answer to.
Perfect, Adam.
So my question is just to see if we can, or if you guys can articulate a little bit more one point. We often argue best when we argue by analogy, and so both biology and history have been raised as places one might look to find, you know, in physics we have a certain way of thinking about things, about what we do when we try and answer problems, and here you're suggesting, no, we need a very different approach. So, and perhaps Stu can chime in on this as well, because it seems like it's going to take more unpacking than we've done. Particularly if there's a period in the early universe, very high energy, when there's a competition between laws, and that is what we mean by there's no laws, that there's, you know, many different, they're competing with each other, there's some fitness landscape. Can we try and do a little bit more with what that would look like, how you'd work with that, how you'd formulate that? Is it mathematical, or you give up math?
That's the task. I don't think we should engage in that here. That's exactly how you go about doing research to develop these ideas.
Okay, thanks. Sean, over here.
Yeah, I'm not sure to what extent my question's already been sort of covered by Barbara, but I mean, I think my sense of the people who are asking questions about what do you guys mean when you say changing laws, if I can't, I can usually just reformulate them in some kind of meta law, is that you're talking about changing the law by fixing the field content and the parameters and everything. But when Stu Kaufman was talking yesterday, I think the important point that I drew was that is the phase space that's changing in an unpredictable way. So that strikes me as something that you cannot understand in terms of a Lagrangian. You can't understand it in terms of standard paradigms and effective field theory. So I was wondering to what extent you think that could be an interesting thing to explore, or whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea or whatever.
Anything that develops the idea in a way that leads to testable consequences is an interesting thing. I've published 4 or 5 different versions, some of which led to exact experimental consequences. I encourage people to develop other ideas. I think it's a new subject.
Well, I agree. I did say what I was discussing was naive. And by this, I mean exactly what you said. So it could be a lot more complicated, and it could be complicated in a way that doesn't fit into any of the formalisms we're using, in fact.
Okay.
Next question. I'm very puzzled by the notion of changing laws. So in order to write down a law, I guess what I would have to do is list a set of axioms. So I list some axioms, whether they're axioms for meta-laws or laws. And then from those axioms, I want to derive some consequences. And I can have shallow consequences or deep consequences. So at what point do we want to use the word law? Do I want to use the word law at the initial postulation of the axioms? And then changing laws would mean I throw away those axioms and invent a new set of axioms. So I'm puzzled about the question in this kind of a very elementary kind of framework.
I think you're a slave of logic.
Aren't we all, to some extent?
All but Joao, apparently. Stefan.
My answer is really the same. You all are getting your feet into the pond of this research program and come in. You know, the water's fine. Come on in and try out different ideas. And let's just make sure that we're good scientists and we try to have have consequences which are experimentally testable. It doesn't have to be.
Okay. What do you have?
Kind of playing off of Ikar's statement. I don't know if this is a question, but so my foot's in the pond now. So my statement and question is it's kind of like in affinity with loop quantum gravity, which is you have a change of variables, let's say, and that allows you to talk about things in terms of networks. Right, so that language of networks becomes amenable to other systems like biology, for example. And so related to that is the notion of time scales. So in superconductivity, for example, that's a very good example of the interplay between intuition and the mathematics, because Leon Cooper was able to solve the Slater determinant, which was thought to be impossible, by a physical idea of the Cooper pair. That's what he told me. And so there as well, you have this notion of a coherence length. So my question here is, when we think about change in laws being able to change, should we also think about different time scales? It's like, so we might have a time scale that's more fundamental, but emergent at the same time, than, say, a different time scale, a more microscopic time scale versus a macroscopic time scale. Again, this is it's more of a proposal than a question. It's probably been explored before, but I just want to put it out there.
Yeah, that sounds to me like an open question for us all to think about, so I'm not going to go to the panel for that. Marina is next in line for a question. And then I'm going to finish this section at 1:30, regardless of who's managed to speak. So try and be very quick for the last. There's two more questions after Marina.
Okay, so Stu yesterday was making the point that we can't define the phase space to be some phase space at the beginning of the universe, and then we continue with that and carry on with our Lagrangian formulation, and so define from there the entire history of the universe. So he proposed the notion of the adjacent possible, which is something that you, Lee, have been familiar with for a long time. And there have been questions here on how we could do physics if the phase space is changing all the time. And so I wonder if you ever thought about a mathematical interpretation or formulation for physics that incorporates that constant change of the phase space from Stu's adjacent possible.
Yes, so here's another version which was published by Nambu, and which I found at some point. Nambu said maybe there's a series of universes cyclically which go through a Big Bang, expand, contract, there's another Big Bang, and so forth. And every time there's a new Big Bang, some particles are added to the fermion spectrum. And so we just see the lightest ones, but there could be no desert at all, but just if there's been many Big Bangs, there's just many, many generations. And Nambu said that's why we call them generations. Only we have the order wrong. There's some, they're coming down rather than going up.
Okay, we take a point from Raphael. We're at the very short points section. Okay, so he's promised three sentences maximum.
I'm caught here. I'm trying to serve two masters. Andrew was telling me, don't talk many times, short sentences, but Marina told me I wasn't speaking enough. So you let you, I'll let you two decide. You were okay, so I'm allowed three sentences.
Three sentences, in addition. Yeah. And you've used two and a half and of I've them already.
yeah, I'm down to minus two sentences now. I just want to say that I think that laws, from a certain point of view, laws must change and come into being if you accept that the universe, the cosmos, actually had a beginning and was very simple. Like I have my own picture as a causal set of a few elements. There's not, so to speak, enough material basis or material structure there to support the kind of complicated laws that we have now.
Good. That's good, yep. I think you did fine. And a good example for Enrique, who will then also speak only three sentences.
I just wanted to pick up on this unpredictability of the phase space changing. So my question is, if it's unpredictable, how are we going to deal with that scientifically? Are we supposed to try to make a law that will predict the unpredictable, how it will change? And furthermore, so let's take an example with Fermi weakened and then the electroweak interactions later, because that is specific. Will we be able to something change there in our interpretation of nature and we introduce different degrees of freedom? And after these unpredictable things happen, will we be able to formulate laws in hindsight that tell us how these phase space is incorporated into a whole that changed or how do we fit that?
I don't think it's very complicated. If every time there's a big bang, the parameters of the effective field theory change by small random amounts from what they were, the people in the new region of space-time measure what they were and discover what they are in their region, and they remain relatively fixed while the temperature is low, and then they mutate or fluctuate a little bit in the next big bang. Everybody gets to make measurements and find out what the parameters of the effective field theory are in their region of space-time.
Okay, thanks very much. Time to move on to the next topic. I'm conscious we've spent roughly two-thirds of our time and we've almost entirely focused on things brought up by the first two talks. So I'd really like to bring Laurent more into the discussion, which is done by going to his topic around, well, it started what is change, it's also now become what is time, which I would hoped everyone knew before they came here, but apparently not. So particularly at the start, I'm very keen to have contributions which are directed towards the issues that Laurent raised in his talk. All is remarkably quiet.
Everybody knows what is change or what is time? I mean, lots of people talked about time as being change. So what do they mean? Is it just a change of word or? Yeah, first question. And then, so what is time?
We'll start with Carla.
Behind you said something earlier. What do you mean by
time? Right? I think that after a week that we're discussing that, it is coming over and over the point that by the word time, we mean different things. I mean, why we keep falling back? I mean, there's something we all agreed upon, is that when we say time, we might indicate different things. So we may say Newtonian time, we say special relativistic time, we say proper time in quantum mechanics, in general relativity, we can say clock time, we can say universal time, we can say cosmological time, we can say Friedman time. There's a long list of times. So, and then after, everybody here can make the difference between this, okay? I think almost everybody. Dinner time and so on. And then somebody says, what is time? And which time? And now, change is a different story. Change is, I think it seems to me that nobody here has challenged the a statement that seemed to come from all the sciences, including biology, including physics, including politics, including history, is that in the world there is change. Namely, things are at some moment and are at thermodynamics time. Thank you very much. Thermal time. Can you add thermal time? This is my preferred
just thermal.
One. There is change. But the difference between change and time is crucial, is very simple. Aristotle time is a measure of change. Okay, change is a passage from some state to something else. He wanted from potentiality to actuality. We want some variable, some value of some variable to other value of some variables. We can measure change with one time or another time. So time is a measure of change, which can have some local property, some global property, can be universal, can be different for people, go different directions, can be measured by a good clock, by a quantum clock, and therefore can give unitary, not unitary. I don't think there's anything mysterious in all this story. What is mysterious is, or what we might disagree upon, is not the meaning of these things. We can just, these are just definitions. What is the question is, if we want to do a quantum theory of the world, how did God design the world? I mean, did he put a universal time, or he didn't? Is the best theory description of the world, we haven't found it yet, with or without a universal time? And let me just make a final comment. We seem to be, in all this radicalism, we seem to be forgetting that standard physics with laws and everything is unbelievably successful, and we have witnessed fantastic results in theory in the last years, each of which, you know, Planck gravitational waves, Planck results, the Higgs, each of which screams, oh guys, that's fantastic, the tools that you're using for physics. Let's keep using before dreaming of using new ones.
All speeches aside, I feel like everybody missed Laurent's point, so I'm going to make Laurent's point again in a sentence. We all believe and teach our students that the lapse is not measurable, that the lapse is gauge. And Laurent showed us that by just making a simple interference effect and constructing a modular observable a la Aronoff Bohm, an aspect of the lapse can be physically well defined and measurable. And I think that's an extraordinary observation. And I felt like it went by so fast. Laurent, nobody got it.
Laurent, do you want to comment? Then it's there, and then.
I mean, maybe the question I was asking is there is a fundamental tension. If you're a relativist and you're an honest relativist, you have to believe that fundamental relativistic probes do not experience time. So, you know, you have a problem. So then you have to place yourself with respect to that. And I think Lee is, you know, I disagree with how he does it, but I think he addressed the question. And he says, well, I have to believe in a global time. Or, you know, you could be like Stu. I don't know, maybe that's, I'm not sure that's what you believe, but that somehow time is only an emergent property of complex system. But if you're a relativist, you know, we have to face that. Do fundamental object, do fundamental particle, maybe that's a question, experience change or time? Or is it only a property of the whole universe or complex system? I think that was maybe, and then I was giving a mechanism by which you can resolve this paradox.
Okay, I'm gonna take Francesca, I think she's gonna address directly this point and then come back to George. Sorry, George.
I just want to make a comment following what Laurent was saying. So forget about absolute time, all these definitions. Let's just talk about quantum time and the quantum nature of time. So one lesson that we have learned in quantum gravity is the fact that there is a fundamental discreteness. And the fundamental discreteness is not a fundamental discreteness in space. It's not just the fact that we have a discrete eigenvalue for area and volume and so on. There is a fundamental discreteness in space-time. So in particular, one of the things that we have been seeing is the fact that because of the structure of the dynamics of general relativity, in the same way in which you discover that there is this discreteness for space, this yields to a discreteness the same way in which we have a discreteness for the area, we have a discreteness also for a Lorentzian area that seems to point in the direction of a discrete time. So in this sense, I connect to what Laurent was saying, that there is a fundamental, minimal element of change. So when we talk about change, quantum gravity seems to point in the direction that there is a minimal amount of change that we can measure.
Thank you. Do you want to comment on that, or should I move on to George? I'll move on to George.
You can approach the question, what is time, in two ways. One is have a theoretical one, but the other side is to say, how do you measure it? And you measure it, and you said you have to have a good clock. So how do you tell what is a good clock is your problem? And the question is, a good clock is a good clock if it agrees with other clock, and we end up going around in a kind of a circle. And it comes back to the thing that in the end, measurements between different clocks, let's say an atomic clock, electric clock, whatever, are relative measurements, and somehow or other, in the end, it's a consensus. It's a whole group of clocks which kind of agree in the way that they work.
Thanks.
Maybe in terms of that, and in terms of the point I was making, it was about I was asking, can you measure proper time? So proper time is a notion of duration we use in particle physics, and if you think that the world is fundamentally relativistic, then you have a problem. I mean, classically, you cannot measure proper time. So for me, it's a fundamental puzzle, because I would like time to be extended not only to the large scale, but to be a property of the small. And I take that seriously. And for me, the beauty is that one option, that's not the only option, but you know, is that you're saved by quantum mechanics. You're saved by the fact that quantum mechanics reveal invisible observables that are not classically observables, the Aronoff bound phases. That was the point.
What do you mean? Proper time can easily measure.
So in a model, yeah.
Is it two mirrors that count how many times a loop bundled lines bounce back and forth?
So there's two ways you can measure. I think, yeah. The thing is that if you accept, it depends. So there's two ways where you're not wrong, but what you're assuming here is you're assuming that you have an hybrid description of physics, which is okay, and that's maybe the way to go. So the hybrid description of physics is that somehow part of the physical system is fundamental and quantum, made of quanta and particle, which follow relativistic laws, and the other part of the system is let's say the gravitational background or the electromagnetic field background, which is somehow behaving in a more classical manner. And if you have that, yes, you can definitely do that. And that's the other option I didn't have time to talk about. But if you try, you know, I'm trying to be a quantum gravity, so I'm trying to, if you try to think that everything is fundamentally relativistic and quantum, then there's a little bit more work to do. So if you agree that there's a given, God-given split between fundamental objects, which are small, and big objects, then yeah, you don't have a problem. Yeah, only not classically. That's essentially the point. It's okay. It's the mirror are okay. The mirror. Give me a description of the mirror in terms of the process I was telling. That is in terms of these collections of relativistic objects. So that's not what you're. When you're talking about the mirror, you're talking about semi-classical objects that you know is some kind of approximation. So if you split your system, so you know the simple point I was making is that if I force you to define what is change, you have to tell me a little bit more how you interact. In order to define interactions, you have to take your big system, the universe. I think the whole universe by itself doesn't interact with anything. So what you have to do is separate it into subsystems. And here, you're taking this separation for granted, but I want to do more. I personally want to start from a fundamental description of physics where I include this description in subsystems, and I try to understand the process you're just describing from, you know, fundamental laws. I think that's our role. If you really believe in, if you're, you know, a theoretical physicist, you have to tell me, what is the property of creating an interface between system one and system two? And then how these two systems interact with each other, and how come a relativistic interaction leads? Because every fundamental relativistic interaction doesn't allow a measurement of time. So what is it classically? What is the mechanism by which it becomes possible?
I tend to agree with everything that Carlos says usually, but now I actually find myself in a disagreement because I think there is something extremely deep, frustrating, and hard to understand about time. Because you gave a list, but what you gave, this is a list of clocks, right? The clocks. And certainly, I mean, we all agree that there are clocks. The question is, do these clocks measure something? Do they clock measure something which is, you know, independent of clocks, or they are just clocks that behave in some way? I think this is the term. I always find it very puzzling, and I don't know the answer to that. So when I was actually asking, what is time? That was exactly my question. Does it exist something beyond clocks that the clocks measure?
Carlo, you made that comment already. I won't make that comment, but I don't. Jurek, I'm confused that you're asking that question. I think all of us relativistic physicists think that there is causal structure, and the causal structure is invariant and physically meaningful, and time is an imprecise measure, an imprecise way to keep track of the increase of causal structure. I don't see that that's conflict. I mean, apart from, Carlo, you made several times a big speech about that, but I'm glad that if you want to discuss that, but the issue of what is time relative to what clock measures what and so forth was never the subject that Roberto and I or with Marina and that we were concerned with. We were concerned with a completely different set of issues having to do with how future events are generated from present events.
Okay, take another one from Barbara.
Yeah, I'm asking myself, what is the basic unit of change or the elementary event that constitutes change in time? It should be irreversible. So my suggestion would be, so it must be related to measurement process.
Anyone want to answer that? Nope. Francesca's going to comment. You want? Oh, did you have a comment of your own, which is short?
I think that's a great question.
Ask a question to Lee.
Okay. Short questions only at this point.
So yeah, the question is, since you were sharpening better what you wanted to say together with Roberto, that is about this fundamental nature of change, I would like to challenge you again. So is there a preferred sequence, or is possible to have, so this change can take form with many different sequences in our universe, or there should be a unique sequence?
Rather question, is a partial ordering time or is an absolute ordering? That's
short answer. Roberto and I have each have a different emphasis here, so I'll state my view, and my view is that what's important about this research program to me works both ways. There are a number of reasons why I think it's interesting to contemplate a total order, but I'm not deeply wedded to the notion of a total order. And those mostly have to do with issues that have yet to come up, like the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. So I think it's too late to go into that. Roberto, I think, if I can say, has a stronger attachment to there being a global time.
I'm not sure how chaotic it might be. Okay, Dick hasn't spoken yet, so I will add an extra bonus question to the session.
Gets five.
Well, actually, it's the complacency which everybody greeted Lee's interpretation of Laurent's statement that you can actually measure by a Hronek-Bohm type effects an absolute lapse. And I don't get that. If the experiment is properly stated, then you should be able to see that the entire structure is going to be logical and the diffeomorphism invariance isn't going to be broken. Which is what you were basically saying, Lee, which surprises me enormously because it would prove your premise if it were true. And then everybody who is a great relativity expert here seemed to just let it go. How can you do that? You were making a claim, and I think that if you go in... Well, no, you were claiming what he said was a claim that absolute...
So I have to ask Laurent, because I can easily screw up. Did I say
I think that what would happen, I mean, it's a great model that you had where you were, you know, going around in a loop, as we do all the time. But if you interpreted that loop in different gauges, you would have the same final interpretation if the theory was well formulated.
By definition, a loop observable is gauge invariant.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So therefore, yes. If I go to a different lapse framework, I would get the same result.
Yeah, you would get the same result.
And, which means that you aren't measuring lapse. In any absolute sense.
I think Lee, maybe, you know, no, I would support Lee in what he was saying. Is I think it's the same debate with Aronoff-Bohm phase, right? I mean, Aronoff-Bohm phase, you know, you can't say you're measuring the potential. Of course, you have to have qualification of that. So I think in that sense, that's what, you know, he was saying. It's just that classically, it's impossible. But you know, if you look non-local.
You are saying that a quantum mechanical effect allows you to nail the lapse, are you?
No, my understanding from Laurent's model is that if you could pass the space-time, a region of space-time geometry through an interferometer and have two distinct paths for the space-time to evolve in, which then came back and interfered, you could design a modular observable to measure a phase which would be measuring a lapse difference on those two paths.
Okay, so what you're saying is you could construct an experiment that would try and prove your absolute time hypothesis by showing the general relativity plus the quantum system.
I don't think he was trying
to make you make it.
Oh no, I don't think there's a connect. I mean, I don't think there's a connection between what I say and supporting absolute time. That's okay. No, I'm not. What I appreciate in Lee is that I think Lee, I totally disagree with his conclusion and that, but I appreciate that at least he's facing a problem which we have to face as relativists, is that, I mean, if we talk about the system as a whole, and in fact, you know, and we are relativistic. Okay, there is no change. Okay, H is equal to zero. In any closed system, in relativity, H is equal to zero. Now let's go. So so maybe there's a third option to Lee. So Lee is uncomfortable with that, as am I. Okay, now Lee wants to put a time for the whole system. I don't. I accept that somehow I give up the idea that physics is about talking the universe as a whole or closed system. It seems to me that what we have learned in the two revolutions, quantum mechanics or relativity, is that physics is about how subsystems relate to each other. And it's about, okay, how, you know, the observable one is related to two. And in fact, the Aronoff-Bohm phase is very interesting observable because there is no way to measure an absolute Aronoff-Bohm phase. It's always relative to a separation into subsystems, like the momenta. There's many observables in physics which are of this kind. Now, you know, the reductionist point of view of physics is that physics is about closed subsystem. And what's happening in the revolution more and more is that we have to give that up. And that's very hard for fundamental physicists. Physics is more and more about subsystems. It's about relations between subsystems. It's about interface, the physics of interface. And that's, I think, what's going on here. If I agree, Lee, okay. So then I both agree with Lee that, you know, that's a problem, and in the sense that we have to explain the emergence of time when we separate into subsystems. Lee wants to do more. I don't think it's necessary. I'm happy to say the universe doesn't evolve. But
okay, I'm going to need to bring this to a close because we're almost out of time. That's okay, that's fine. We're not going to be able to talk about precedence. I'm going to have to assume that's because we haven't talked about it before, which I think is a clever joke. Maybe. Thank you. Now, what I was impressed with at the start was the howls of derision that I was given when I suggested that you should give your opinion on a question which is listed as one of the main questions of the conference. But I accept your howls of derision. I'm going to let Marina work out how to resolve that.
So some of you were saying that, you know, we're not asking the right question, and I think that's a very good way to maybe see what we are all thinking about, what are all the different questions we have, and this is something that would have been very nice to talk for a little about and hear what each person has to say. We have a concert of clocks at 6 o'clock downstairs. Yes, yeah. There are 100 clocks downstairs, and so we have to go. What I was going to ask is if some of us or all of us could identify one question that for you is important, that if you can let us know what that question is, then maybe tomorrow at the end of the session we could have a vote on what are the relevant questions for the audience as a whole. Maybe that's a bit more informative, although this is also very informative. So a proposed method, if you have a better one, you can let us know, is that if you have a question that you think is important and condensates or summarizes what we've been discussing, you could write it down somewhere over there on that part of the board, and you could make it anonymous or non-anonymous. And tomorrow we will have a vote on what everyone thinks are important questions to ask.
Yeah. Thanks, Marina. I should say, cosmologists love to do that, and it is, you know, who knows when there'll be so much expertise on time again in one room.
Yeah, just to say, the concert is in the atrium, and it will start in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Also, it's followed by the banquet.
So please let us all go to the atrium. First floor, yes, on the first floor just outside the bistro. There's 100 metronomes there ready to be going.